20 seconds early. Let's roll. It is the last live podcast of 2023 for the Survival Podcast. Anyway, we are going to have the Christmas special tomorrow, and we'll have a Friday flashback, rewinds and flashbacks next week. We'll be off for Christmas Day. We'll take off 1st January for a recovery period from New Year's Eve, though I don't think I'll need much recovery period this year. Get older, you get wiser. And then we'll be back rearing and ready to go. So just know this is a special episode. I've got our guest Michael on. He'll be on in just a moment to talk to us about guns for the modern survivalist. And I got a little humor that we'll hit on when we first bring him on and too as well, because we've got to laugh at the end of the year. Anyway, before I bring on our guest today, Michael, let's go ahead and remind you guys about a few things. Number one, I got this hands-on composting class coming. It's either going to be January 6th or 7th, assuming the weather cooperates. The reason it's 6th or 7th is because if the weather doesn't cooperate on 6th, maybe it will the 7th. Right now, I've got 4 students. That's enough, and I'm sure we'll get one or two more at least between now and then. So we are a go on this class if you've been holding back. This is going to be an awesome class. If you read the write-up on it, I even made a video explaining it further. If you've been to a composting class here, there will be some innovations at this one. There's going to be a formal Q&A as part of it, and we're using it to finish the composting course that we're about to release next month. Next up today, let's talk about our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day, number one today, JM Bullion. If you ain't paid attention, the government and the Federal Reserve and the bankers seem to want to devalue our money at every opportunity. Like, they don't let a second go by without spending a dollar that we don't have, or a couple million dollars that we don't have, to the tune of $30+ trillion of debt and no plan whatsoever to ever pay it down, let alone off. That means your money will be continue to be worth less over time. I recommend certain things for preserving your wealth. One is silver and gold. The other being Bitcoin is primary means, and then investing in your homestead and things like that, your tools, your knowledge. Building a business. So I've never do a one, you know, a magic pill. And so silver and gold aren't magic pill, but they are part of your wealth assurance program. The reason to get your gold and silver from JM Bullion, they got better pricing than everybody else anyway. They do all shipping for free over $200. And if you're buying silver and gold, you probably should be buying about $200 and up. They do a discount for members of the MSB. And they've been supporting us for 10 years. They're such a great sponsor that when Lear Capital asked to be a sponsor, I told them to go F themselves. I only need one, and JM Bullion is the one that I have, and it's the one that you should use. Next up today, the Canine Academy from Joel Riles, the founder of Fortress Canine, is a trainer. He realized his ability to help people with their dogs is fundamentally limited by geography. So he went and built this online platform with some really great courses in it. And I recommend everybody at least consider taking the Canine Academy Basics course. If you do that, you're going to get that core obedience. And no matter what you want out of your dog, if you want a hunting dog, if you want just a good homestead dog that doesn't kill your chickens, you want just a dog that is respectful around company and kids, if you want a dog that's a protection animal, I don't care what it is. It all starts with core obedience. And ask any good dog trainer, what is the most difficult species that he has to work with? And if he knows what you're asking, he'll say humans. The dog's easy. The human's the hard part. Canine Academy will train you to train your dog. So definitely check them out today. With that, I want to bring our special guest on, Michael Milito. How do you say your last name, Michael? I don't want to screw it up.
It's Milito. It's like military Milito with an O instead of an IA.
I would have got it right, but I probably would have picked one of my other options because I screw things up. Anyway, before we get you going here, I want to acknowledge the elephant in the room on the thumbnail. We have a liberal AR-15 for our episode art, meaning that the magazine is in it backwards. And that was the best that I could get out of AI today, and I decided instead of finding a stock image, go ahead and roll with it. But what I wanted to do for people that haven't been by the Telegram list or on Twitter or Nostra yet today is show them some of AI's other attempts. Michael, have you ever used a handgun like that one in the top, the two in the top right hand ever in your life?
No, they look pretty interesting.
I have a friend that is a huge gun enthusiast that's always at our workshops. I kind of want someone to 3D print one of those. It obviously won't work. And just hand it to him at the next workshop and step back and watch his brain fry. The one in the second row with like the straight handle, I know people listen to audio only don't understand this, but you would if you saw it. That almost looks like something somebody put together in a garage that could actually exist.
It looks like, yeah, something somebody made in like the wilds of Afghanistan somewhere. Yeah. Worked up.
That could actually be a thing. Some of these other ones, I don't know what they're supposed to be. How do you like the first pistol? That's either a light or a laser sight. I'm not sure what, but it's pointed. It's so you could shoot yourself in the foot, but I think you're going to miss.
Well, hopefully if we go to war with AI, if that's the apocalypse upon us, that'll buy us some time because our guns will shoot themselves, I guess.
Yeah, when people are afraid of AI, I'm like, you ain't used AI, because if you do, you're going to realize we got a long way to go before Terminator. Let's just start out, though, Michael. Let's tell people a little bit about your background with firearms, since you're here to talk about guns today.
Sure. First and foremost, I'm a Christian. I grew up backwoods of the South hunting and fishing from a real young age, putting meat on the table, probably so young if kids were doing it today at my age, somebody would call CPS, but that's what we did. You know, we put meat on the table. And I joined the Marine Corps at 17, did a couple of combat tours. After my combat tours, I was an urban warfare instructor for the Marine Corps. I went to work for LAPD, worked regular assignments, patrol, more specialized assignments, fugitive recovery. I also served in the U.S. Army, both full-time and part-time National Guard. Been a private contractor for a three-letter government agency. I don't like to specify because they're not obviously affiliated with the show. But I was a private contractor. I've been a professional firearms instructor for the FBI, for one of the big training schools in the country. If I said it, you knew who they were. I've been a professional big game hunter and guide, trapper, still a lifelong hunter. Been blessed to hunt all over this country, from whitetail on the East Coast to mule deer and elk on the West Coast, and just was hunting last night. And I guess there's more, but that's probably enough in a nutshell.
No, it would say that you know your way around firearms a bit, from what I always say is the practical to the tactical.
That's it.
I have a great affinity for tactical weapons. I really like them. They're cool. I'm a guy. You give me something that looks cool, I like it. I've been known to buy a tool and put in my toolbox just because it looked cool. But also, I think the things that get me the most excited are more of the sporting arms. I'm a big hunter, so I get excited about both sides of it, and I think that's a good, well-rounded approach. When you're a hunter, you tend to have that rounded approach. Can you kind of talk about, if someone's new to firearms, though, where do they start? I realized when I started doing this show all those years back, a lot of things that I just thought everybody knew, no, they don't. And I mean some real basic stuff. I mean, I thought every young man knew how to skin a deer. Somebody didn't know how to skin a deer. I didn't get it. You know, I didn't understand it. And I do now. So when you start talking guns and we start whipping out words and ballistics terminology and accessories and all, there are people that go, okay, they're speaking gun nerd. Where do you start if you're new to firearms?
Yeah. And that's, you know, without putting anybody down, you know, not everybody grew up like we did with a gun in our hands, and not everybody had an uncle or a father that would take them out and show them the ropes, and that's not their fault. And it can be quite the hurdle to how do you get into it, because it seems like this kind of separate world, the separate universe that you kind of have to be grafted into. But I don't think that that's true at all. It's a tool, like you said, like anything else. It's a tool, but most people operate a several thousand pound tool every day that's exponentially more dangerous than most firearms are if you handle them safely. And nobody worries about that. But it is something to respect and something that does take some knowledge to get into. So I'd say knowledge is the first thing. A lot of people, I think, do it backwards. They might go buy a gun, which is their right. There's nothing wrong with that. But then they go buy a gun and they say, oh, now what? So I would advise you to go get some kind of training, even if it's just going to a basic local range and paying for an hour of instruction. Walk me, you know, most decent ranges will do that. They'll walk you through. They'll have you handle the gun. They'll have you load it and unload it with snap caps or that kind of thing. And that a lot of times will just kind of take off that initial apprehension of handling a firearm. I think that's a good place to start. And then maybe rent some guns, maybe go out for a round of sporting clays, have the coach go with you and show you, and then think about what kind of firearm you should get instead of running out of fear when somebody's getting elected and buying a gun and then you just look at it because you're afraid to touch it.
Yeah, because no, a lot of people
buy stuff out of fear, and you shouldn't do anything out of fear like that.
No, I completely agree with that, and I did that with my wife, because the first rule of teaching your wife to shoot a gun is don't let somebody else do it.
Yeah.
Every good instructor I know, when they have classes, if a husband and wife come in, the first thing they do is put them on opposite sides of the classroom and tell them they're not allowed to talk to each other.
Oh, yeah. I'm professional. People pay me a lot of money in the past to teach them how to shoot. I don't teach my wife. She could get it for free, but I don't teach my wife. I pay somebody else to teach my wife. Absolutely. It's just a different dynamic.
You know, and I even had some ideas when we were getting her a carry gun, like what she should carry. And then what I did, I sent her to the range, and she did got an instructor, basic handgun safety, loading, unloading, shooting, and she shot several different guns. And the gun that I particularly thought would work well for her, she's like, I don't like that.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know what? As long as the hole goes in the bad guy, I don't care what you carry. I want you to be comfortable with it. And that was... You know, if I had just gone out and been like, well, what you need is a 38 snub nose with no hammer. And she would have said, I hate this gun. I would have said, oh, okay, so I got a new 38. But you know, that might have worked out for me, but it wouldn't work out for her. And I think that for anybody, like that same approach of go to a range, most ranges have various people to act as instructors, just like trainers at gyms, kind of like those type of arrangement, and shoot a variety of different things and get a feel for it, because, you know, there's people that love Glocks and there's people like me that think they function perfectly, but I hate them.
Yeah, right? I'm not the guy that's like everybody should just get a Glock and just learn how to shoot the Glock. And there are a lot of instructors like that, and there are a lot of schools like that.
Yeah.
But even when I was the commander of a tactical team and I was writing policy, I let the guys shoot and carry what they liked, because the point of the firearm is to hit a given target. And if you're better with a different gun, that should be the main thing. And you're not going to know that unless you get out and try different guns. And there's not guns, especially handguns, more than anything else. They're not a one-size-fits-all tool. They're not a everybody gets a Glock 19 and you're good. It'll work for sure, but you might find something that works better for you. And that's one of the great freedoms we have as American firearms owners, is we have, especially now, we're in the golden age of like firearms and carry guns and carry permits. There's so many good choices.
Awesome, man. So let's move on from there. You get ready for that first gun. And we just said that none of them are one size fits all, but do you have some general recommendations about maybe where people should start?
Yeah, and it's actually probably not with a carry gun.
Agreed.
Like you said, guns are tools. And unlike, I think there's this big divide in the tactical, the gun world. You have like the hunters and you have the tactical people. And there's honestly a lot less crossover than you would think. But if you look at it from a tool perspective, in my opinion, the most versatile tool is a shotgun. So a decent shotgun, a decent pump action shotgun is hard to beat for the money. And nothing is as versatile as a shotgun. Nothing like last night I was out hunting quail. Nothing will take a quail out of the air and stop a charging grizzly bear and also defend your home and be a great truck gun. And it's just a great place to start. So if that would be my number one. And my number two would be like a bolt action 22 or a Ruger 10/22 is fine too, but a 22 because the amount of practice that you can get for the money, which is one of its big advantages if you're getting into guns over a shotgun. Because shotgun shells aren't expensive, but they're not as cheap as 22. So I would say shotgun or a 22, both are pretty versatile. My number one would be a shotgun.
I would actually completely agree with that. But I would also point out one of the advantages of the 22 over the shotgun from a training standpoint is not just the cost of ammo. It's the fact it has very low report.
Yeah.
So, like, I haven't done it, but I really should put a berm in here. I can shoot here, but there's no direction that's truly safe. Be discharging a weapon based on how close my neighbors are. But if I had a berm, I would be totally comfortable shooting a 22. It's also not going to upset my neighbors who hear people shooting all the time. If I'm over here cracking off 12 gauge for a long duration of time, now what's going to happen is they're going to call the sheriff's department. The sheriff's department is going to ask them where they're from and say, you must be new. But it's still going to cause some level of response where, you know, the little pew, pew of a 22 is just going to be mostly ignored.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I did mention the bolt action, because even with a bolt action, you can shoot the, as opposed to a semi-auto, you can shoot the CB caps and the Calibris and the shorts, and they're even quieter. I mean, especially if you have a new shooter that is recoil shy, like a CB cap, you get all the same marksmanship training, but without almost any perceivable recoil or noise. And a lot of times noise bothers people more than the actual felt recoil of a gun, unless you're doing it wrong, is not painful, but it's the surprise of it. And the 22 does get rid of a lot of that. And on that note, if you're new to shooting, I always double ear protection. Just double it up anyway, even if you don't think you need it. Put the inside ears and the outside ears. A lot of times for new shooters, it is the noise and the concussion and stuff that bothers them more than the felt recoil does.
Now, one thing I've always done with training new shooters, especially with a shotgun when they're shooting like clays, is I'll stand behind them and load the gun for them.
Yeah.
And I'll hand it to them, you know, once every five or six or seven times empty.
Mm-hmm.
And the first time they lift that head up and lower that stock, they actually see that they've done it. And they start believing you when you tell them you're picking your head up off the gun. I know you've done it where you're like, hey, you're picking your head up off the gun or, you're whatever. And they don't believe you, or you're flinching. They don't believe you. But when they, or if they're bench rest shooting a rifle and they, because the report and the recoil's not there, they see it.
One of the old tricks that we do as instructors is we take their magazine and we'll load several live rounds and several dummy rounds and we'll mix them up so they don't know where they are and do exactly that. Just so they, and it's funny, once they realize it, it's the fear of embarrassment more than the miss that causes them to actually pay attention and listen and do what they're supposed to do. Which is kind of funny, but it works really well.
The day that became part of what I do all the time, I was actually out shooting clays with some buddies. It was like a work thing. And it was totally informal. We just had some traps set up, and it was like a drop-off on this guy's ranch. And I wasn't hitting. And that's unusual for me. I mean, shotgun, I'm probably better with a shotgun than a rifle and pistol put together. And I had a misfire. And the minute I had that misfire, I saw myself pick my head up just like a centimeter. And then everything was dust after that. I'm like, I'm totally making this part of how I teach people to shoot. That's one of those things, I didn't learn from the uncles and the grandfather and all, but I think they thought ammo was too valuable to play games or something.
And I'm big on dry fire. I think dry fire is absolutely most of the time better than live fire. You learn more and you can do it and it's free. As long as you have a modern gun that it's not going to harm, like I wouldn't do it with an antique 22, but most modern guns you can dry fire and it's free. And you will learn a lot more about yourself and about shooting in dry fire than you will live fire. It's a fact. It just, most people don't do it because it's not as fun, but it absolutely pays big dividends if you do it consistently. Kind of like going to the gym, right? If you only go to the gym and bench press once a year, you're not going to be great at bench press. If you only go to the range and live fire once a year, you're not going to be great at shooting. If you dry fire, like doing push-ups, it may not be as good as bench press, but you do push-ups three times a week, you're going to be better than if you do it once a year. It's just dry fire is absolutely, I think, underutilized.
Form, habit, muscle memory are huge there. So like when I'm doing that, one of the things I also do is not just dry fire. I don't even know what the term would be, like point acquisition maybe. I'll take a rifle, iron-sided maybe, look at a spot on the wall, close both of my eyes, bring the rifle to bear and open my eyes, and then say to myself, 2 inches low left.
Yeah, I call that natural point of aim, whether it's with a handgun or a rifle or a shotgun. I do that as part of a training regimen too. Like you close your eyes and you go to present and you open your eyes and you're like, oh, well, I got to move my feet over a little bit and I'm going to do it again. Okay, there we go.
Yep. Yeah, and it becomes second nature when you do that long enough. And it's not that you're no longer looking at the sights. It's that the sights come to where they're supposed to be, I guess is the way I would put it. So
yeah, it's like you said, like anything else, repetition breeds familiarity, breeds comfort, breeds predictability. It's often attributed to Einstein, but I don't think he actually said it. What's the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results.
Correct.
If you flip that on its head, you can't expect to do different things all the time to get the same result, which is the key to accuracy is being consistent. If you want to be consistent, you have to have the repetitions doing the same thing over and over. May not be cool, may not be sexy, but it gets the job done.
Yeah. In martial arts, we say slow is smooth and smooth is fast.
Yeah.
And it's the same type of thing. Don't worry about being fast. Worry about being accurate and speed will come with time. Like you will begin to move faster and move smoother if you focus on it. As we start looking at guns, though, and you get that first gun with a shotgun or a 22 or whatever, there is a similarity between guns and the marketing of Lay's potato chips. Right? You can't do just one, right? Like, Lay's has made that a chemistry experiment, and you will eat the whole bag and get fat. With guns, though, almost everybody ends up, if they buy a gun and they actually shoot a gun and work with a gun, as they want another gun and another gun and another gun. And sometimes I think they get kind of lopsided. And so I like to talk about kind of a battery, a balanced battery of firearms that allows someone to do all the things, defend the home, put meat on the table, train, maybe carry. How would you approach kind of what does a basic gun battery look like if someone develops experience and makes investments?
Sure. And I'm going to look at this from a practical, you know, what you say, modern survival battery, not from like, because there's a guy that only shoot competition with an AR and they've got 20 ARs, no other guns. Yeah. And that's fine. But if you're talking about a modern, practical, mostly capable, because you can get some real specialized guns, like a prairie dog gun is a very specialized gun. And I love hunting prairie dogs. But we're talking in generalities that will do most things. I think we started with the core, which would be shotgun 22, right? Yep. Whichever one you don't get first, get the other one second. Get a shotgun and get a 22. And then after that, you might want to start looking at a good handgun. I would not fault you. In fact, I would probably commend you for getting a decent 22 handgun, analogous to the, if you're looking at carrying a semi-auto, get, you know, something that functions and clears malfunctions and loads and unloads like a modern semi-auto, but in 22. I'm not telling you carrying a 22 is the best idea, but it'll certainly work if that's all you have at the time. So I'd go with a 22 handgun. You already have the ammo for it. You're already familiar with shooting a 22. It's great training. If you want to carry a revolver, then get a 22 and a revolver if that's what you're looking into. And then after that, I would say build up to a good center fire defensive handgun of your choice, depending on what size you're going to carry. And realize with handguns, a handgun is a compromise. A handgun is better at almost nothing other than being able to carry it. It's not the best defensive tool. It's not the best home defense tool. It's not this or that. It's not the most ballistically effective, no matter how much John Wick runs around shooting people with it, right? It's there because you can have it on you. So realize that to begin with. And realize that the smaller you go in handguns, which is often a myth, the harder they are to shoot in general. There are exceptions. But if you go smaller, like uber small, they're going to be harder to shoot. So with that in mind, get a good, decent, modern centerfire defensive handgun. Doesn't have to be Glock. I'm not here to tell you what I pick should be what everybody picks. But a good, modern, reliable, defensive semi-auto handgun. And then probably look at a centerfire semi-automatic defensive, whatever you want to call it, kind of capable combat style rifle, whether it's an AR or a Mini 14, or you want to go big or go home and get an M1A, something like that. And then if you want to get into deer hunting, you know, whatever that is in your state, whatever is applicable to you, a bolt action 308, it's a great, pretty much all around recommendation. And that's a pretty good battery.
I think that's right where I would end up. I might, depending on the person, put the centerfire hunting rifle ahead of the tactical rifle, because if someone breaks in your house and you shoot them with a 12 gauge, their days of screwing shit up are over.
Oh yeah, for sure.
But either way, it gets the same place. And then I might also tell the person that's never going to hunt, you don't need a scoped rifle. Yeah. You know, in the configuration we're talking about. And then in some states like Texas, you can get a tactical rifle that is also your hunting rifle. It all depends. Yep. Like in Pennsylvania, that you're going, the rabbit sheriff is coming to put you in the rabbit sheriff jail if you're out there with an AR hunting deer. In Texas, everybody's like, that's a nice AR. How many deer do you shoot with? Yeah. Right. So it's
not the best hunting rifle, but you certainly can do it. And especially for modern times with active shooters and stuff that we have, I briefed over in the bio, but I was a commander of a tactical team to stop active shooters here, CONUS here in the U.S. Active shooters are a real thing. Active violence is a real thing. And that's kind of why I went with the, I think as much as I love hunting and you love hunting, we got to admit that the vast majority of the U.S. population doesn't hunt. Wouldn't know how to skin a deer if you halfway did it for them and dropped it in front of them.
Nope.
And that's fine. Not everybody's going to learn to hunt, but I think if you're, and you could disagree with this and you may decide it's not you, but I think as an American, you ought to have some kind of decent modern rifle.
I agree.
No. Modern defensive rifle. So, but yeah, but basically the battery is the same. And if you have those, and I'm not a gun collector. People might think that I am, that I have like a whole wall full of guns. I have more than that, but I have a core battery. And if I have a gun that's not really serving my purpose and it wasn't handed down by my grandfather, which I have one of those shotguns, you know, then it goes and I get something that actually fills that purpose. Cause I'm not a gun collector. I'm a gun fighter. The name of my podcast is Gun Fighter Life. It's not gun collector no life. It's not cool widget life. It's gun fighter life.
I will admit that I have a little bit of a collector problem there. I've actually prevented myself from getting a CNR FFL just because I know that it will make my problems worse because my ease of purchase easier, and I like old military stuff and all. I have basically two problems, and that's probably a good number to stop at. One is different types of cutting boards, and the other one's different types of guns.
I'm not saying those are the only guns I have, but in general, I, as much as I love old guns too, and like I love an old finely made shot, like an old Belgian made Browning, you know, A5. Yeah. I love those. They're gorgeous. Yeah. But I have a Benelli M3, and if I'm going out to hunt with an old classic shotgun, I'm gonna bring my grandfather's shotgun, which is not a Auto 5. So it's just not a gun that I really love, and I would love to handle. And if somebody handed me to one to hunt pheasants, I would love it, but I'm probably not going to buy one. That's just me. They're beautiful guns, and I totally get why people collect guns. That's just not what I'm recommending here.
Yeah, I have a pre-World War II Browning A5 Belgian made, and they're
sweet.
But it's probably not what I would want if I was going to do a three gun.
No,
I'm not out there with my A5. I'm in a dove field with it, you know.
And you probably don't want to drag it through the mud when you're duck hunting, goose hunting, and it's snowing sideways. Like, just because you got so much memories with it, probably bring out a more modern gun that's got a chrome lined barrel.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, especially with all the steel shot bullshit now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Don't get me started.
I don't
want to
deform that modified choke.
Yeah. But they're gorgeous. I still the one family heirloom that I have. We grew up pretty poor, but the one that I have is my grandfather's side by side AH Fox.
Oh wow!
I still love that thing, and I thought about it the other day when I was going out to hunt pheasants. I was like, I grabbed that old Fox. It's beautiful.
The gun that is the most valuable to me sentimentally is like probably the gun that has the lowest financial value of anything I own. I grew up with it. It's a old bolt action Model 25 Marlin 22, 7-shot magazine. And it's because I've probably put 50,000 rounds or more through it.
Oh, yeah, they're fantastic. Those old Marlins and micro groove barrels, it's a shame that they went under and they don't make them anymore because they're phenomenal guns.
Oh, that thing will still drive a dime out at 50 yards. And it's
they're fantastic.
You'd think that a barrel would start to lose its integrity. But like you said, those old micro grooves that's one of my things. People say, you know, what should I buy at a gun show? If you find one of those, they're not expensive. Even the used ones, buy it.
You know what I would like to get at a gun show if I found one for a reasonable price. I looked on GunBroker and they're outrageous. But the old Marlin takedown lever action 22s with that, and they took down. Oh, just phenomenal. But if that's a gun that would be a go to survival 22 for me if I had it, because they take down, their lever action, could shoot the shorts out of it. Be great. Be an omnivore. But I love the old guns as well, for sure. I know you like the 760. I love the 760. It's probably one of the most practical. Like, if you wanted one rifle that would kind of bridge that gap between decent defensive rifle and a great hunting rifle, a 760 all day long, for sure. Yeah. They're fantastic.
Yeah, if you can find the older 760s especially. Yeah, that was my dad's gun. That's why I like it. The one I always look for and never see at a gun show is the Marlin Camp Carbines. And I found a 44
Magnum with a 16-inch barrel.
Yeah, and it looks like a Tommy gun that was quarterized, you know. It's short. It's got it's mag fed, and I've seen a couple of them in 9, but they made them in 45, and I've never seen one at a gun show in 45. And you basically have a semi-auto Thompson. And they only made them for like 10 years. And they haven't made them.
You're talking about
the
semi. I was thinking of the guide gun. I was thinking of the 44 mag guide gun. I gotcha. Yeah, those little camp carbines are pretty cool.
Those are awesome. And I don't know why nobody makes that. The closest thing right now, sadly, is the High Point makes their carbine in a 45, but that is not an equivalency. It's just
Henry just came out with their Homesteader, which looks a lot suspiciously like that old gun. It's the Henry Homesteader. Uh-huh. But I looked at it, and talking about practical, the thing weighs as much or more than an AR. So I can't really just like if it's grab and go time, probably not grabbing a PCC that weighs as much as my AR when I could grab my AR. It weighs almost as much, I think, as my SCAR 17. So why would I grab it when I could grab the 308? But they're fantastic little guns.
I'll show that gun so the people in the video anyway know what you're talking about. Yeah, now that you mentioned that, I had seen that. Yeah. So it's a 9mm carbine that weighs like an AR. I don't see the point there.
I don't either. Cool, and that's the big, yeah.
You know, it's like putting some booze in front of an alcoholic. It ain't my favorite, but I still like it.
Yeah, it's still cool. It's still cool. I could talk about cool old guns that are just neat all day long with you. Like the old the Ruger Deerfield carbine, that 44 mag semi-auto. What a great, great little gun.
Oh, those were great. The semi-auto 44. Yeah.
Yeah. Those are fantastic.
I remember when that gun came out, it was like cover of Sports and Ammo or Shooter's World or an NRA or something. I remember it right on the cover, and I was a teenager. That's how old that is. And I remember thinking, I'm going to buy one of those, and I never did.
I know, and now they're just crazy expensive, and yeah, they're gorgeous, though. They also, for a brief period, when I was a kid, I remember looking through the gun magazines and loving that stuff, too, and I remember seeing when Ruger came out with the lever action. They came out with the lever action 44 mag and the lever action 22. I wish I'd have gotten one of those, because those are just really cool. They're kind of one of those things like that gun. They're kind of ugly, but they're kind of cool looking. You're like, they're really neat. I kind of want one. And it's just one of those things.
I've got a few lever action 44s and 357s, but they're all Marlins. The gun that I always kicked myself that I didn't buy was when I was like 16 years old, and there was a department store called Laneco, because we didn't live where they had like Sears. We had off-brand department stores. That's how remote we were. And they had these M1 carbines, the 30 carbines, with everything, the oiler, the sling, like still Cosmoline on them. They just literally unwrapped them out of cases, and they were freaking $78.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't remember those days.
85 or 86 or something like that. So that was still more money than it is today. But even at the time, that was – you know, a decent 870 shotgun was $350.
New. Yeah, when I was a kid, a lot of us rednecks hunted with the SKS because it was the same deal. It wasn't the best hunting rifle, but it was $75 for you said, wrapped in Cosmoline.
Yeah,
I wish I'd have bought a dozen of those things.
Well, I remember when the Yugos of those came in. I bought one. I should have bought a case of them.
Yeah, yeah. Because now they're $400 or $500.
$75. Yeah, brand new, never issued. Yeah.
And you talk about SKS is a great all-around. It used to be really good budget survival carbine, but it's still a great all-around crossover. Like I said, growing up, that was like the poor man's hunting rifle because the ammo was cheap, the guns were cheap. Many a poor country boy put meat on the table with an SKS.
And it worked. Mosin Nagants were real popular where I grew up for that because you couldn't hunt with a semi-auto for deer.
Oh, because
that was one. So the old like OT6 Springfields, if you had one of those, you were rich. Well, poor people had Mosin Nagants, you know, and then you had to pay more for ammo than the gun. So what are some common misconceptions? We're just kind of riffing as two old boys here that like guns. But
I could talk about guns all day. Yeah. We could go about myths all day, too, but I'll pick out a couple. The one that you don't have to aim a shotgun.
Just
hand some lady a shotgun for home defense. You just point it in a general direction. It'll make bad guys, you know, go to the bathroom in their pants and run away. You absolutely have to aim a shotgun, especially at room distances. You absolutely have to aim a shotgun.
Were the patterns about the size of the top of this coffee cup?
So to illustrate that point, when I was LAPD, we trained to take hostage shots with a shotgun, with buckshot.
Okay.
Because at room distances, it's a fist.
Yep.
And you're probably more accurate with that and a shoulder-fired weapon than with your handgun. So we trained hostage shots with buckshot. And if that doesn't illustrate that you have to aim a shotgun, I don't know what does.
Well, I think the other thing about that is that I looked at an informal study a guy did years and years ago, and it goes back to your comments about handguns, where a handgun is a compromise at all times. It is a compromise. It is because you can carry it. And he went through, like, from 22 up to 45, all he did was just go into the media and get every report of somebody being shot, whether good guy, bad guy, bad guy, good guy, didn't matter. You were shot with a handgun by caliber, and he broke it down to, did it kill the guy? Was it a first round stop? You know, or did it require multiple shots? And the difference between something as weak as the 22 and like a 44 Magnum was not, there was a difference. It was not the definitive difference that you would expect.
Yeah. Well, we and went for the listeners that want to look that up, I believe that's Greg Elefritz's handgun stopping power.
I mean, it's damn old. I mean, the one I'm talking about was back when I started, it was available.
It's very old, but I still think it's the most comprehensive, where he looks at like thousands of street shootings, good guys, cops, bad guys.
That's
it. And just like lays it out, just unbiased statistics. I think it's the best one we have.
And I don't remember exactly. It was like 76 or 77, somewhere around 75% of people shot with a shotgun was a one-shot stop.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily fatal, but you were done with the fight for the day.
Yeah,
if you weren't dirt napping. And there's something to be said for that for defense. If you break in my house, I don't want you shooting back.
For sure.
I want you dirt nap society.
Yeah, for sure. When I was I mentioned I did some more specialized assignments in law enforcement. I literally had access to an armory with literal Tommy guns. We still had them in the inventory from back in Prohibition days, like full auto Thompson submachine guns. I had all kinds of submachine guns, you know, all kinds of stuff. Most often when I was kicking down a door because I thought somebody in there might try and kill me and I wanted to come out breathing on the other side of all those things, I grabbed the Remington 870 with buckshot and slugs because it was what I thought was the most likely thing to keep me alive in that situation. Not what looked cool on Instagram. Instagram wasn't even a thing back then. Not what was super cool shooting steel on a range, but what actually works and puts down people when you need it, a shotgun at reasonable ranges, which for civilian defensive encounters is almost certainly inside 150 yards.
Yeah.
I can't think of any outliers, really. It's the most devastating small arm you can get. It's the most effective, and it's often the most affordable and least messed with by politicians. So don't look a gift horse in the mouth. They're a fantastic option.
You know, the name of this company is escaping me now. I'm on their email list. It's part of my problem. I need to not be. They always come up with crazy shit. Like they just had the Mausers from Last Samurai that were actually used in the movie, and they will fire. They just will only fire one round at a time, and they're like a 10.5 millimeter or something. But they had a shotgun, and I don't remember who made it. I think they were Italian made. Pump action. Stainless steel. I almost bought two of them just for the hell of it. They were like,
well, you know, Jack, not to feed your addiction, but if it's the old 10 millimeter something Mausers, I think you can convert those to 45-70.
You probably can. I don't need
that. That would be pretty neat.
It came with a certificate signed by the producer of the movie and everything. And I tried to go to a couple of my buddies into buying ones just so I could hold it and not have to buy it because they were like $1,100. And, you know, it's just an ego thing, but it was just kind of cool that they were actually used in the movie. And the firing ones, they also had prop guns. And the firing ones were only like $150 more than the prop gun. I'm like, so I ain't
buying it. Yeah, because most people that buy that are going to hang it on their wall probably.
Yeah, so. I'm still going to buy the one that fires. I don't care for $150. But yeah, I think that the shotgun thing is a big myth that, you know, you just point it and pull the trigger and whatever.
Another big myth, if I've transitioned us here, is with handguns and remembering that a handgun is a compromise. It's almost never a better ballistic choice. There are certain situations where you want one hand or something where it's a good choice, but a handgun is a compromise. It's not the most effective for stopping power, for sure. Not even close. But even within that, the small handgun fallacy, and I see this most common with women, but not to put down women. I absolutely want women to be armed, and I think they should be armed as much or more than men because they're more likely to be the victim of a violent crime. But I see this a lot as a professional instructor with women or have in the past, where they look at a selection of handguns and they pick the small one. Well, all other things being equal, that small gun is going to be harder to shoot, less forgiving, probably more punishing on you than a larger handgun of the same caliber. So if you're looking at, let's say, 9mm, because it's the de facto defensive handgun caliber of our time, like it or not, it just is. It's the standard. If you look at the 9mm, and you look at a full-size 9mm and a super subcompact 9mm, unless there's some weird anomaly like a bite your hand or something, the small gun is going to be harder to shoot, more punishing, and less ballistically effective because you're losing velocity out of the shorter barrel. So especially the reason to go with a small handgun is because that's the only thing you can conceal.
Correct.
If you can, go with the bigger handgun. And I think that's a big misconception of people. They go to get their first handgun and get a little teeny tiny one. And I think a lot of it is, it doesn't make sense when you say it out loud, but it's like they're less intimidated by a tiny gun when in fact it should be the opposite. I've seen it a lot with people selecting their first gun. They want the small one because they're less intimidated because it's small, but it's harder to shoot than the larger handgun. So if you're starting out with a handgun, my advice is to go with a full size fighting size handgun. There's a reason that those are combat handguns because they're more effective and easier to shoot. But that's a big thing I see over and over again. And I got to kind of illustrate it with like somebody new. And but if I put both these handguns on the table and I can somehow pull the trigger, the little tiny one and the big one in 9mm, which one's going to fly back farther? The little one, because it has less mass. That recoil is either going to go into the mass of the handgun or into you, the shooter. So get the one with the more mass so it's more forgiving. And I think that's something that people don't really, when you say it, it makes sense like as far as physics go. But when they just are new, they almost always gravitate towards a tiny little handgun, which is usually the worst choice.
I agree with that. I'll also tell you the other one that I hear that's kind of in the same vein of that, and I always hear this at gun shops, and I always try to keep my mouth shut. Sometimes there's places I have a hard time not intervening with stupid salespeople, gun stores and nurseries for plants. Like those are the two places, like just everything this guy just said was wrong. And, you know, the guy, they're looking for a gun for the wife at home when he's away. They're looking at the little 380 and the 9mm and the 45. And he's like, well, if you get the 380, you just have to be a little bit more accurate. And I'm like, oh, Jesus God, why? Why do they let you talk to people? Right? Like, as though if you got the 9mm, you just shoot him in the balls and he'll die. But if you got the 380, you got to hit him right in the heart. I mean, that's the way it comes across. And either way, getting shot in the balls probably will stop you from doing what you're doing. But know what I'm saying, where they start talking stupid like this.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. There's a lot of that. And again, if it's for home defense, like if you're – I'm not saying a handgun is the best choice for home defense. I'm not. Yeah. But if you're going to – a lot of people do pick a handgun for home defense for whatever reason. It's easier to lock up or whatever. If it's for home defense, why? Why would you go with a small handgun? Go with a big handgun. A handgun is – I love handgun. I've done the vast majority of my competition wins, and I didn't mention the bio, but I'm a state pistol champion several times over. I do most of my practice with a handgun. I love the handgun. I love it because it's unforgiving and it's hard to master. And the smaller you get, the harder it is. Don't make it harder on yourself if you're going one for home defense. Get a full-size fighting handgun, like a 1911, a Beretta M9 size, a full-size Glock. Yeah. If you're going to go Glock 17. Don't go uber small. It just makes it harder. The uber small handguns have a place if that's all you can carry. If you're wearing board shorts and a tank top, by all means, get a pocket gun. I like my
summer in Texas. My handgun goes down in size.
Yeah, yeah.
Because otherwise, you're printing everywhere you go, and it's uncomfortable.
I generally carry a full size fighting handgun, but like if I'm just taking the dog out and I'm literally wearing shorts, 357 Magnum in my pocket, it's great. But I realize that that's a compromise of a compromise. In no way is that the best choice for defense. It's just what I can have on me. Correct. But if that's not your limiting factor, don't go with a small handgun. I see that a lot.
Go ahead.
A 38 Special J-frame or a 357 Magnum, even more, like small J-frame revolver, pocket revolver, that's an expert handgun. And I see it recommended a lot for new shooters. It's a great gun, but it's a hard gun to shoot well. Yeah. It's an easy gun to make go bang, which I think is why a lot of new shooters gravitate towards it. But it's a hard gun to shoot well.
I think the reason people recommend those, though, inform people anyway, is that, yes, it is. There's nothing. You pull it out, you pull the trigger, it goes off. But the other thing is that the person using that for defense is probably shooting somebody that's arm's distance from them. Right. So as long as we can at least have the discipline and understand basic pointing, you're going to hit. You know, and I think that's why people do that. Now, the reason I like a shotgun and a handgun for defensive purposes in the home, it's 2:00 in the morning and somebody's knocking on my door and there's a car out in the street. This doesn't happen here because I got dogs and fences now, but, you know, in the suburbs or something, and there's four ways going out there. Well, that could be a person that legitimately is trying to get help. or it could be somebody trying to break in my house. And I probably don't want to be sitting there with my carbine or my shotgun when I open the door. But, you know, just behind the door is a surprise if you're in need of a surprise. And I think that there's a place for both of those in that home defense situation. But I'm with you. I don't need a compact weapon for that. One of my old service 1911s would do just fine for that.
Yeah, and I love 1911s too. They're a great choice. But going back to, like, a lot of people recommend that super small J-frame, and I like revolvers too. I love revolvers. But yeah, if you're recommending it to a woman for home defense, recommend to her a mid-size or a full-size 38 special revolver.
Completely agree.
Yeah, like a Model 66 or one of the old Smith & Wesson cop trade-ins that you can get for a song and a dance nowadays. Like a full-size 38 special that a cop used on his side for decades is a better choice than an uber small one.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also say, as much as I don't personally like Glocks, and I just don't like the way that they point and handle, there's nothing wrong with the performance. But again, if you're at home defense and down distances, you know, I'm not too worried about, you know, how I would score shooting in a three-gun competition.
Yeah, a Glocks, they have the ergonomics of a 2x4 is the way that I like to put it, yeah.
But where I was going is the service gun. So I haven't been to a gun show in like a year. I'm trying to cure myself. But not the last one, the one I went to before, they had like law enforcement, Glock, and 40 Smith & Wessons. And let's be honest, most cops hardly ever fire their damn gun.
Yeah.
And they were
I say it all the time. I was a cop. Most cops are not gunfighters. They are clerks. They're administrators.
They were on return. Like, the departments were upgrading or some shit. And these are tritium sights and everything. And like four magazines in a case. And they were like $350.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm like, if you don't have a handgun, that's screaming by me.
Yeah, I've recommended the same thing. I did a whole show on like law enforcement trading guns because, like you said, most cops, like we go back to, I'm not going to get off on that because I was a cop. It's a hard job, but that doesn't make them a gunfighter. Most of those guns, they weren't shot very much.
No.
You might get the one cop like that shoots competition on the side, and I was that cop. But most cops, what they shoot once every 6 months, that gun will last lifetimes. They're a great buy.
Yeah, I guess you call him my nephew-in-law, my niece's husband, who's a sheriff's deputy in Colorado, and he's detached right now to a federal task force. He told me part of the reason for that is a lot of departments now, if you want to shoot, you got to buy ammo.
Yeah.
Like he said back when he started, there was a certain amount of practice ammo that you could requisition that was paid for by the department per annum for training. And that all went away, and they have to buy their own ammo, and ammo's gotten expensive. And he said that's part of the reason, but he said a lot of the guys just don't give a shit.
Yeah, that's a big part of the reason, because if your life depended on it, my life depended on it, like nobody's buying our ammo for us, right?
Yeah.
But we still get out and practice. Like if you're a cop, how much more – I should get off my soapbox. But if you're a cop and it's your duty – I see it as my duty. You see it as your duty to protect life, and you should be good at it. And if the department's not buying you the ammo, then you should buy your own ammo. That's just on you. Just like being part of a well-regulated militia, like we all are.
Correct.
Like it's on you. Like that's part of being well-regulated is you regulating yourself, not somebody else regulating you. And
yeah, I have another family member
your skill or lack of it is on you at the end of the day.
Fortunately, since I'm going to say this, I have quite a few family members who are in law enforcement. But I have one in particular, and, you know, he carries everywhere he goes, on duty, off duty, whatever. But I've shot with him. It is not impressive.
No.
It is not impressive at all, man. It's like, you need to shoot more, man.
Yeah.
You know, you really do.
Well, I'll pick on myself here. I was a cop for a long time. I was LAPD, which is like the longest, it was at the time, longest, hardest law enforcement academy in the country. And I was decent as far as cops and LAPD went. And I went to my first shooting competition, and I started shooting competition and precision rifle long before I joined the Marine Corps at 17. I was a gold medalist before I joined the Marine Corps at 17. And I went and shot my first handgun, practical handgun competition, and I got disqualified. I got schooled. I got humbled big time. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm not that good. Maybe I should actually go practice. And I started actually going, and I could have went two ways. I could have went like, well, this is stupid. This isn't real. Or I could have went back and ate some humble pie and kept going back till I got better, which I did. But to your point, it just because somebody gives you a tin star on your chest does not make you great with a handgun. That's just that's not how it works. And qualifying once every 6 months, like going to the gym, if you only do something once every 6 months, you're not going to be great at it.
You're not going to develop the muscle memory at all. And I grew up shooting handguns. My big, like, hello, the world is different than you think it is, when I joined the Army, was M16s.
Yeah.
And shooting with your nose up on the charging handle and peep sights and all the way up on it. And I had to, like, actually listen and learn something. And it was amazing to me how quick I went from this is weird. Oh my God, I can knock down targets at 300 yards with iron sights.
Yeah.
Because you listen. And that would be one of my big things. If you pay somebody to train you, shut up and listen and learn.
Yeah.
There's
and
a reason you hired an expert.
Yeah. And I will often go and just literally take a basic course, just a NRA basic course. The day you start thinking you're too good for the basics and the fundamentals is the day you start being bad.
Yeah.
Just when you think you're too good for the fundamentals, and I miss all the time, right? I practice all the time. I miss all the time. When I miss, it's almost always, sometimes it's the gun, but almost always it's because I failed to execute a fundamental properly. It always goes back to that. You're never too good for that. You're never too good for a basic class, a basic course, going back to getting training, just a basic course. You might know more in a certain area than the instructor, for sure. But if you go there with an open mind, willing to learn, you'll almost always learn something. I don't think I've ever been to a training class where I didn't learn something.
I'll say that I have had rifles where the scope go wonky or something, or you tried a different brand of ammo and it was so radically different that it wasn't even printing, and it's the gun. I've never been able to blame a handgun for why I shot like shit. Never. In the end, it is what it is, right? And you're not taking 300-yard shots with it unless you're just showing off or something. When I've missed with a handgun, it's always been me. It's never been the gun. It's maybe misfired or like you get a squib round and it tumbles through the target or something. Those are always fun. But I've never had the gun go bang, properly cycle, and miss and been able to honestly say it was the gun. I might have said it, but I was full of shit when I said it.
I mean, I've seen it. I've seen sights fall off of handguns. I've seen Glocks have sights break. But my point is the de facto generally is it's you. You start with what did I do wrong, and then maybe you're pleasantly surprised if it's the gun, but usually it's you. No matter how good you are.
If the guy shoots like shit and hands me his gun and the front sight fell off, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And I've never seen that happen to anything except I have an airsoft gun the front sight fell off of.
Yeah.
That's all I've lost the front sight on, but okay, I would give you that. What about concealed carry? Like, I'm big on, I tell everybody, you should be open to it. You should take a course. You should learn about it. Maybe you should get your permit. But I also kind of say, like, maybe not everybody should carry or carry in all instances.
For sure. It's a big responsibility. And I think before you start carrying, you should look, like, do some introspection, be circumspect about yourself, about who you are, and consider if you should be carrying a gun. Because not, like you said, not everybody should. Everybody should have the right to, but not everybody should. Like, for instance, and this is not a knock on anybody, but a lot of veterans are suicidal. If you're suicidal, maybe carrying a handgun is not for you, at least not right now. And that's just the reality. And I don't want to, everybody should have the right to, but everybody should be honest enough with themselves to think, maybe I shouldn't right now, or maybe this is not the right time, or maybe I'm not ready. So it's a big responsibility. You're carrying something on your person designed to take life. You know, you don't want that to happen. Like, you want to stop a bad guy from doing a bad thing. You want to change their behavior, but make no mistake, it's a deadly weapon. And that's a big responsibility, and you should take it seriously. And all that goes along with that. And going back to the well-regulated part, that doesn't mean by the state. That doesn't mean by some regulation entity. That means you. You are the regulator. You should be, I think. And you should be.
That's how the amendment was written. That's the meaning of regulated.
Yeah, but that's regulated, why I use it. Because
knowing your weapon, knowing how to use it, keeping it in good shape, and being mentally prepared to use it. And when the people make the argument, I don't want to turn this into a Second Amendment discussion as a whole, but when people make the argument that was about the National Guard or whatever, you wouldn't need a freaking Second Amendment if it was about the government and the military. The end. Right. We don't need an amendment that says the military is allowed to have guns. There's no need for that. That is the dumbest argument that any liberal has, or anybody for that matter, liberal or what, has ever made ever. And it shows a complete ignorance to contract law. But I'll let it go.
Yeah. Well, also, if you go to the contract, U.S. Code 10 states that every male from 17 to 45 is in the militia.
Correct. Correct.
So that. That
now we can go on a law discussion. Now, the common law states that any contract written with any ambiguity benefits the party that did not draft it. Therefore, if there is any ambiguity in the Second Amendment, it benefits the people who did not draft it, not the state who did. The
we could talk about that all day, but shall not be infringed seems pretty clear. I mean, but we'll probably move on to something else. We'd probably get mad if we keep talking about that.
But. Yeah, no, but I do agree that, like, a person that's in the wrong mental state probably, like, if I ended up in some kind of dark place where I was thinking about hurting myself, I wouldn't give my guns to the government. But I would, like, phone up my brother-in-law or something and say, would you just take this from me for right now?
Yeah, and that's just one example, but that's just a very clear, obvious example that no, not everybody should carry a gun. So you would think that being, like, the host of Gunfighter Life, I'm like, everybody should have a gun all the time. Yeah. Like, that's not true. But I think you should be honest with yourself, and if you are ready for that responsibility, I think you should see it as your duty as a man, as an armed citizen, as an American, as more than that, just as a sovereign human being to protect life and liberty and freedom and others. You should see, if you're willing to take that step, then I think you should really seriously look at it.
Correct. I agree with that. I look at it this way. Like, I want everybody who can to do so, because the more people that own guns, use guns responsibly, and are out there armed and willing to defend life and liberty, the more secure our rights become. As soon as people start talking about taking guns, when you own one, it's personal. When you don't own one, it's a subjective thing in your mind, right?
Yeah.
However, I also think that everybody should grow up and learn to drive a car. And I don't mean to disrespect anybody's disability, but not if you're blind.
Yeah, there you go.
I don't want you behind the wheel of a car if you're freaking blind. Now, maybe another 10 years from now, autonomous vehicles get there. You can sit behind the wheel and pretend you're doing something. But if you cannot see, I don't want you hurtling down the road in a 6,000-pound, 3-ton vehicle at 80 miles an hour. That would be a bad idea. And if you're in something similar in some way, then maybe a firearm isn't for you.
Yeah, and I love, obviously, we both like guns a lot. That's pretty clear from our conversation. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that everybody has to. I'm not so vain as to think that everybody has to be just like me and carry a gun everywhere. I don't think that's. I think it's your right, but I don't think it's the best carte blanche in every scenario.
Well, so if you believe in rights, then you believe rights go both directions. They come with responsibilities, and that's what we're talking about. But I believe that you have a right to drive a car. Now, the government's put certain hurdles in the way of being able to do that, but you do have a right. But if you don't want to drive a car, I don't have any right to tell you you have to, right? I think that blue is my favorite color. You're allowed to pick red, right? I mean, like, we get in this tunnel vision, I think, sometimes. So it's good to hear you say this, that, like, because the thing is something everybody should be able to do, then everybody should go do it. But we only pick and choose certain important things to us to have that attitude with. No one's out there telling people, well, you have to eat pasta. Maybe you don't like pasta.
Yeah.
Right. So some people don't want a gun. If you're afraid of guns and you're not willing to get past that, I don't want a person walking around that's afraid of the gun that they're carrying.
Yeah.
Right. If you are visually impaired, I know there's a whole thing about that, and I've heard some about it. If you can't see, you probably shouldn't be shooting. At least I've seen some stuff where it's pretty impressive what people can do with direction. But a blind person probably doesn't need to be walking around with a gun.
Yeah.
And I know some people are going to hate on me for that. But I, you know, put a blindfold on, walk around your house for a couple of days and tell me if you still believe that.
Yeah, not everybody should. And I'll liken it to alcohol, right?
Okay.
I'm a Christian. I believe in the Bible. Jesus drank. His first miracle was turning water into wine. I've got no problem with alcohol. I don't think everybody should drink. Some people are suffer with being an alcoholic. Those people probably should stay away from alcohol.
Some people have other health issues that alcohol compounds and makes worse.
Yeah, and should they have the right to drink? Absolutely. Should they drink? No. But they should take it upon themselves to not exercise that liberty. And I think that may not be a great analogy, but it kind of illustrates the point.
We're doing what we can here, in a hot button issue, you know. What do you think practical training for the armed citizen that is going to carry should look like?
Okay, that's a good thing. Like I said, if you if you're getting started, going out and like getting a lesson, like a private lesson, and then maybe taking a more formal class, taking your concealed carry class, which is not mandatory in every state. Like I like to pretty much live and bounce around in constitutional carry states, but even so, maybe get your carry permit. Realizing that's mostly law training and liability training, not firearms training. And then you might look at going to a legit trainer or class. I'm not pushing anybody. I'm not sponsored by anybody, but find professional trainers. And like you said, go there with an open mind. If you are there to learn, you probably will. If you there think you know everything, you're probably not going to learn anything.
No.
But go get some training and then regulate yourself. Right. One of the best things about training is not what you learn in the class. It's learning how to teach yourself. Like learning what a good trigger press is, learning what a good shot feels like, learning what a good draw and presentation is, and then going back and practicing it yourself. I recently drafted this up, and I worked a long time on it, and I put it out there for free, open source, on my podcast about how you can do a practical course of fire on just a paper plate with just a simple stick, a target stand, and a paper plate. Simple, practical, armed citizen course of fire. For the everyman, like you can probably afford a paper plate and a little bit of ammo. It's under 50 rounds and getting out there, dry firing, whatever your regiment is. And then every so often, and not every 6 months, but going out there and shooting a course of fire, I think is a good, like you said, it's a responsibility. So if you're going to do it, you should take it seriously.
I kind of think that no matter how advanced you get with training though, you should try to find some training that is very real world. And here's what I mean by that. Like I went to a class one time and they did shit like they put oil on our hands so that we couldn't rack a slide. And so that we had to rack a slide to clear a malfunction with the heel of a shoe. Mm-hmm. We had another course of fire where basically like four dudes would hold you down and you had to fight as hard as you can for about 60 seconds. Mm-hmm. So that you're shaking and then you run through that course of fire. And that was very useful because it's the way to, as a military person, you have to simulate stress because you can't recreate the exact stress. But there was also a lot of like tandem movement, tactical movement, stacking up, things like that. And like, okay, that's great if you're a cop and you're on a SWAT team or something like that. But the odds that I will ever be in that scenario are very low. The odds that I'm going to come back to my car and somebody sitting in my car on top of a machete, not likely, but much higher. The odds that I'm going to come out to a parking lot and some guy's jacking up a woman and I need to intercede. Those scenarios, or I'm sitting in a restaurant, somebody comes and starts shooting people. All those things are real world shit that happens every day to somebody.
Yeah.
And those are the things that we should spend more time as civilians, in my opinion, training for. Somebody's knocking on your door. Somebody's in your car. Somebody's hitting you up at a gas station. You're pumping gas and all of a sudden three dudes are surrounding you. That shit happens. We got CCTV footage of that out the ass of that kind of thing happening.
Yeah. And this is from somebody that's been a professional gunfighter most of my adult life. I live and breathe that. Like I've kicked in more doors than I can remember. But you're right. There's lots of good trainers, and not that that's bad training, but get training that's germane to you. And if later on you want to throw on a plate carrier and a helmet and go kick down doors just for fun, just to learn that skill, go for it.
Yeah, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just saying that if all your training is based on, let's say, team movement, and you don't have a team, who's got your back? No one has your back. Maybe you should train for that reality. I got three guys sweeping me. One coming up and asking me for change, and I got two guys on both sides of me that are clearly with him that he thinks he's distracting me from.
Yeah.
Are they armed? Do I have a right to discharge my weapon at this point? Is making known that I'm armed a good idea at this point? And the answer to that is it depends. That individual situation, what is my best course of action at this situation? Those are things that literally, again, happens to somebody every day. I'm trying to think of the guy. I think it's Active Self-Defense.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the YouTube channel where he actually takes like CCTV footage of somebody being assaulted and how they respond, and he breaks down what happened. Like, he's never going to run out of material. You know,
I mean, the guy coming up to you at 7-Eleven because you forgot to fill your gas tank the day before at 10 o'clock at night and it's dark, the guy coming up to you that may just want money or may want to stab you. Like, that's a lot more of a practical scenario than running around in a buddy team with a helmet and a flak jacket. So, again, look at good practical training, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's kind of like the the expert level if you want to do that for fun, but realize as a civilian, unless you were like in an organized team, it's mostly for fun.
Right.
But any training, I would say any professional training is probably better than none, but get some that's geared towards what you realistically expect to encounter.
Yeah, that's kind of the point I'm making. Let's turn a corner to hunting a little bit though, because both of us have that in common as well. I get this all the time. Jack, I want to hunt. I live in state XYZ and I've never hunted in my life and I don't know anybody that hunts, and what the hell do I do?
Yeah, and that's talking about getting into guns. It's probably even harder to get into hunting. Like, you and I grew up hunting. Probably our friends hunted, our uncles hunted, our fathers hunted. And could you imagine, like, growing up, I call them people hives, but growing up in like a subdivision where the only squirrel you've ever seen is at the park. Like, yeah. If you imagine what a hurdle that is.
Yeah.
I'm not here to pick on people. Like, if you grew up in that environment, you know, broken home, single mom, whatever, nobody to show you how to hunt, that's a big thing to get into. It can seem daunting. My wife kind of grew up as more of a city girl, got her master's degree, super refined. But she was into guns before I met her, but she had never been hunting. And I got her to take her hunter safety and all that stuff. And she even told me, she was like, if I didn't know somebody, if I didn't have a mentor, this would be really hard to try. And it really would, because like, if you've ever, and I'm sure you have, taken somebody hunting for the first time and just them walking in the woods and it sounds like an elephant and you're like, what is going on? But they don't know, right?
You're wearing clown shoes, man. Knock it off. You clunk, clunk, clunk.
And we laugh because as soon as we get in the woods or on leaves, our whole foot movement changes.
Yeah.
And we know that, but they don't know that. And that's not
their fault. That's because when we were seven and not even able to carry a gun yet, when with our dad or an uncle and we walked like that, we got cracked.
Yeah, they slapped us in the back of our
head.
And
you forget that.
Yeah.
You become so conditioned into, I'm in a different mode now, that you forget that you had to learn.
Yeah. Talking about that automaticity, like when we get off the pavement and we're hunting, we're stalking. We're like a predator and we transition to that mode. But if somebody's never done that, they don't even know they have that mode. They have it. They can do it. They just don't know. So as far as getting started, obviously you're probably going to need to take your hunter safety, get your hunting license.
Yep.
If you have a mentor, a good mentor, that's great. And I would say a lot of people, they want to get into hunting and they focus on deer. Deer, 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 that's all they think about. And depending on what state, sometimes hunting deer, it can seem like you need a law degree because there's so many rules and regulations. And for people east of the Mississippi, public land deer hunting and rifle season is not the way to get introduced to hunting. So as much as you might want to work up to deer, I would encourage you to go back to that shotgun or that 22, talking about the utility, shotgun 22, get your hunter safety, be safe, and try, you know, upland game birds. Pheasant, quail, squirrel, rabbit, small game. Coyotes are everywhere now that they weren't when I was a kid. I mean, if that interests you, something that's a lot lower barrier to entry than getting into deer hunting. I think a lot of people want to start out with deer hunting and they have these fantasies of deer hunting, but it's a lot easier to learn how to skin an animal if you're skinning a small animal than when you've got an elk down on the side of a mountain and you're looking over it. Because I grew up deer hunting and I moved out west. First time I shot an elk, I walked up to it and I was like,
I done?
Like, what? Yeah. What? Yeah. Like, so it's probably not even with a deer. I mean, you can do it. And I've had guys reach out to me that are getting into hunting and I'm like, don't stress about it. If you're taking meat off the bone, you're on the right track. It's not going to explode. It's okay. But I think if you're getting into hunting, be safe, take your hunter safety and try small game hunting. It's a lot of fun. You're probably going to see more. You're going to learn more. If you can stalk up on a squirrel, you can probably stalk up on a deer, right? So it just is what it is. There's a lot more liberal bag limits. You generally have longer seasons. It's probably easier to get private land permission to hunt squirrels than deer. So there's a lot of reasons to go with hunting small game, squirrels, whatever.
This will vary by state, but I think overall it was like 12 weeks of small game in Pennsylvania. You know, there was some breakups in that period because sometimes when there's deer season, they shut down small game. So you can't be out there without your deer tag and claim you was hunting squirrels with a 30-06 or some shit. But in Texas, I think there's only 2 months out of the year we can't shoot squirrels.
Yeah, and some places like Nevada, it's year round. You don't even need a license to hunt jackrabbits and coyotes.
I was just like jackrabbits are year round.
Year round. Yeah, so get out and hunt. Like a big thing that was a shocker to my wife was she'd only ever shot paper targets, and she was waiting for the animal to be still.
Yeah,
and after our first second hunt, I was like, babe, they don't want to die. They're probably not going to be still. If they are still, that's great, but they're not going to stop there and wait for you. You have to get used to shooting at moving targets. And that's one thing. Like if you can shoot a running jackrabbit, shooting a moving deer is the same skill.
A lot easier. That entire jackrabbit is less than the kill zone on the deer.
Yeah.
Right. You know,
and
I'll also say we did a lot on training in this episode, and you want to get training, hunt squirrels. And if you've never hunted squirrels in the actual woods, everything you know about squirrels from a park squirrel that's used to being fed peanuts does not apply. Yeah. And you mentioned they don't stay still. If they stay still, it's probably because they're flat like this against the tree on the back side of it. Right. And you might see the tip of the head and the Y. And if you can hit that, you can knock that squirrel out of that tree. So you end up learning stalking, scouting, being quiet. You end up learning how to improvise rests when you squirrel hunt, especially with a rifle. The shotgun's one thing. With a rifle, 22 is a totally different thing. Your strong side, weak side rest on the side of a tree. Maybe that tree's a sapling and it's not as actually as steady. Like you learn how to, you know, like I have to end up in this weird half kneel position because that's where I can see the damn thing that's figured out I'm after it and it's hidden in this little nit. Like to me, it is some of the best training you'll get. Long range hunting. You mentioned prairie dogs. I didn't grow up where we had prairie dogs. I grew up where we had groundhogs.
Yeah.
And you start going out in the farms and shooting groundhogs at 300-400 yards. How many shots do you get to take like that at where it really matters? Not a lot unless you're doing something like that. And then my other thing with that was in farm country in PA, you got all these guys going to ask these farmers if they can hunt on their land 2 weeks before deer season. And most of them are Dutch guys, and you'll get the hell no, get out of here. That's what you're going to get.
Yeah.
You go shoot groundhogs in June, you can hunt that. I guarantee that guy's going to have you back around. He'll let you hunt, right? I mean, down here in Texas, like I said, it varies by state. You're not hunting deer here without paying money.
Yeah, that really saddens me. It's a big reason I try and stay out west, like Idaho, Montana area. Sadly, in a lot of places, hunting big game has become a rich man's sport, which I don't like. I like hunting to put meat on the table. It saddens me that in a lot of places, it really has become like the landed gentry's rich man's thing, which they have the right to hunt too, but I like to see it as the common man getting out and putting food on the table.
Yeah. And so that's how it started, right? That's all about. The rich people only hunting, that was Europe.
Yeah.
The whole point when we came here was that now a dude with a flintlock could go out and feed his family.
Yeah.
You know,
and you still can in some places. Probably a lot of places back east, not so much. But anyway, getting back to getting started, for sure, small game is a way to go. Also, I mentioned I was a professional big game hunter and guide. A lot of those places are really expensive. If you want a trophy animal, if you want meat, a lot of those big ranches, you're in Texas, that's known for that. A lot of those big ranches, you can contact them about a cull hunt and you can hunt just for meat and it'll maybe be a couple of $100s. But the amount of time it's going to take you to learn that skill and what you'll learn from that guide in one day. And if you just want meat and learn to hunt, that's also a very good place to start. If you don't have a mentor, because I mean, he'll probably tell you to shut up when you're hunting, but But when you get back, you can ask them. And I would love it when I was a guide and I was butchering an animal and they'd be like, hey, can I see how to do that? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, come here. I'll show you. Here's the tenderloin. Here's how you cut it. Here's how you trim it into steaks. Like, I would love that. And I'm sure that most guides are probably that way. So if you don't care about the trophy, a lot of those places have to do population control. And they're more than happy to charge you a couple of $100 to shoot a doe or a buck with a broken antler because they can't sell it as a trophy. You know, for $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, some of these hunts, but you might be able to get it for a couple of $100, which may sound like a lot of money, but you're getting the meat out of it and you're learning. So maybe the next time you go to hunt, you'll have all that knowledge. So that's also a place to maybe, if you're not comfortable going it alone, look at a cull hunt if you have those places in your area.
Now, this place, it is hunting, so you're not necessarily guaranteed to do what I did last time I was down there, but they're a whitetail operation. They sell big bucks. That's what their whole deal is. You know, like 150 class is little. And you know, they're hunts are $8,000 and up for deer like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
They have to manage their herd. They have to manage their herd. So they have a state biologist that comes in and it literally issues them cull permits for does. Because a lot of times they'll say, like, in a buck hunt, it's guided because a guide's sitting there with you and says, yeah, that's how much this one's going to cost, or don't shoot that one or whatever. That one's out of your price range. But once you shoot your buck, they're like, you can shoot a doe, and they just sit you out there by yourself.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of their buck hunters that are there, they're there for trophies. They don't even want to do that. So they've got to get those does shot. So they'll get cull permits. They don't even go off your license. So I went down there. I shot two doe on these conservation permits. I didn't even take a tag off my license to tag the deer. I shot two doe. I shot a pig. Now, for all the talk of pigs being everywhere in Texas, there ain't as many as you think. It was like a 200-pound pig, and my total cost on that hunt was $800.
Oh, that's nice, yeah.
So two deer and a pig for $800.
Yeah.
And I'm like you. I'm a meat hunter. I don't care about horns. I don't care about antlers. I don't care about how long the beard on the turkey is. I don't give a crap about none of that. I want the highest quality protein I can, and I want the experience. Yeah. And if there happens to be a really nice buck and I take it, okay, great. But I don't really care anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And like those cull hunts, I think they're kind of a hidden gem. And I didn't even know about them until I was a professional hunter and guide. And we make our money when we're doing that with the trophy hunts, obviously.
Yeah.
But like you said, they need to take them out. And they're more than happy. And I can't speak for every operation, but many of them are happy to take you out on a cull hunt for a very affordable price. And you'll learn a lot. You'll learn a lot from the guide. You'll learn a lot about, like I said, most of them, I would assume, because I was that way, we'll teach you how to skin an animal, gut an animal. You know, here's the heart, here's the liver, you know, here's how you preserve them, all that stuff, which you might be able to learn on YouTube. YouTube's a great resource, but there's something to be said for getting your hands bloody and actually doing it. And I think that's also a good way to get started in hunting.
Now, just for people's clarity, the type of hunt I'm talking about, your guide drives you out to a blind and says, see you in 4 hours, for that price. They're not, because they're with those more expensive hunters doing that actual guiding. But when they pick you up, they'll absolutely do what you said. You can give them $25 and they'll skin and quarter the deer for you, or you can ask them to help. I would still pay them if you're like your first guide.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Right.
Yeah. And you should always tip your guide. As a former guide, you should always tip your guide.
Yeah, absolutely. But they'll walk you through it, or you can do it yourself and what have you. And I mean, they even have a walk-in cooler. So like, I've gotten back late, skinned a deer, left it whole, and threw it in the cooler and quartered it the next day, which is actually great because it's nice and stiff and it cuts nice. But, yeah, there's hunts out there like that. What I would caution people on is they're great ways to get experience, but some of these hunts are so regimented. You might learn processing and shot placement, but that's about it, because they're putting you in a spot. They know deer are going to come there, and they like, that's Fred. You can't afford Fred. You can shoot Tom. So you don't learn scouting. You don't learn tracking, et cetera, unless you take more of an active type of guided hunt.
Oh, and see, that's almost the only way that I grew up hunting in a stand. I can't stand it. Almost exclusively, I spot and stalk and still hunt. And there's nothing wrong with stand hunting. In many places, especially back east, you have to stand hunt because there's just not the land. But when I hunt and when I guide, I almost always spot and stalk and still hunt. So if that's what you're interested in, then find a hunter or an operation that stalks, because stalking is almost exclusively.
So even with that, like, so if you're going to go out and stand hunt, well, you don't just go into a random place, throw up a tree stand and go sit in it, right? You have to pattern the animals, et cetera. And what I'm kind of referring to is in some of these hunts, so much of that's already been done, food plots, feeders, all kinds of, that like, there's literally all you're doing is plopping down your butt and shooting off a rest like you're on a bench. So even if you're going to stand hunt, if you're going to be able to do that on your own, you're going to have to, okay, here's a funnel where the woods narrowed down and there's a scrape line up there. And, you know, I've observed this and there's a pattern and there's fields over here that they're probably feeding in the evening. And you have to learn all that. And when you hunt with a guide, unless he's doing that, and you specifically tell him that you're as much interested as learning as killing, you're not going to learn that part of it, if you see what I mean. Like,
fishing
guides, for instance, I tell you when you go fishing, I tell the guide, I'm going to give you an extra $100 on this trip, teach me the lake.
Yeah.
Right. It's a little harder to do with hunting than I think it is with fishing.
It is, but I think it still could be done. Even, like I said, I don't like hunting from a stand, but if you ask the guide, hey, why is this stand here? Like, why did you choose to come here?
Yeah.
Why did we drive this way? Why did we not drive this way? Because the guy probably, like, when I was doing it, I would just know, and I would, yeah. It was like second nature. Yeah. Like, oh, because the wind is blowing from the north, so yeah. We're coming from the south. So, but if they were interested, I would certainly explain that to them. Why is this stand here? Like you said, because there's a neck in the, there's a funnel in the woods, and they're going to stay in cover as long as they can and only expose themselves to cross this gap. They're not going to walk 500 yards over an open field when they can walk 20 yards through this little funnel.
Correct.
And that's why we're here. And if you ask them, why are we here? Every guide, I'm sure their person.
I was going to say, yeah, you might want to make sure that you let that guide know when I ask you questions, it's because I'm a dumbass and I know it. And I'm not questioning what you're doing. I'm trying to learn.
Yeah, and that's like anybody. But maybe you go the first time and you get a bad guide. I'm sure there are bad guides.
There's bad guides.
But I still think you'll learn a ton from like a cull hunt. I still think like a lot of you and I take it for granted because we know why that stand is there.
Yeah.
But if you have no idea, then if you ask why is the stand here? Well, because this is the end of these oak trees, and these are white oaks, and they love these acorns, and that's why this stand is here. And you're like, oh, well, maybe when I'm hunting, I should look for white acorns. I should look for white oaks.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You'll get out of it what you put into it. So if you just show up and you want to kill an animal, then a guide's going to get that done for you as quickly as possible and pat you on the head, tell you did good, and move on to the next client.
And to be honest, a lot of the I don't want to say like a lot of the clientele, that's all they want
to
do.
They want
to check a box. They want a big trophy. They shoot the animal. They might go have a glass of whiskey and you're in the shed gutting the animal.
Yes.
And that's fine. That's my job if I'm doing that. There's nothing wrong with that. But
the place
they're not there to learn.
The place I mentioned that I hunted last year and did that, when the night that I shot one of the deer and I was in there skinning it, there was three guides skinning deer and me. And everybody that was a hunter was around the campfire getting drunk.
Yeah.
That's what they want. And they'll do that for you. That's you know.
Yeah. For them, a lot of people, that's their vacation. And if you want to get back and have a glass of wild turkey on your vacation, hey, sit around the campfire. But
I'm not saying I didn't have a glass after I was done with my deer. I'm just saying that there's people that's what they want. And so – In Robert Rourke's work, he talks about how the guides in Africa would say, I'm still drinking their whiskey, because those are long-term hunts, right? And that basically meant that this guy was just a straight-up business client. I didn't get close to him. I don't care for him. He's all right. His money's green. But we go out, he shoots a thing, the boys skin it, and we go on about our lives. And I can't wait to get rid of him and get a real client in. And there's people like that.
Yeah, and from the guide's perspective,
it's easy.
Like, most people aren't guides for the money. Right.
Yeah.
I walked away from a big, well-paying job to be a guide. I consider it like an expensive working vacation. Like, yeah. I don't think many people are guides for the money. They're probably a guide because they love the animals and they love hunting. So if you get a client that really wants to learn and is excited about hunting, I was ecstatic. I would assume most guides, unless they're just having a bad day, got a divorce or something.
Yeah.
They're probably the same way. They're like, oh, you actually want to learn? Like when I had a dad bring out his young kid to teach him how he got me to teach his son how to hunt. You know what an honor that was for me? And he had his son come in there and learn how to skin an animal and gut an animal. It was one of my favorite memories because he knew that he didn't have the skill and he paid me to teach his son, which was very humbling for me because hopefully that kid will take that on for the rest of his life. And that was super exciting, more than the money.
We're having conversation in the chat here about the guns again. So we just continue on, but I'm just going to put that up for the guy that was pointing out the error. And we'll wrap up here while they get a look at that and a laugh. Hopefully, can you just kind of end with, if you were to answer the question, why do we own guns? Like, cause I get that from a lot of non-gun people all the time. Why do you need a gun? I always answer that one with, well, what kind of car do you drive? You know, I drive a Lexus SUV. Do you need a Lexus SUV? No, because I want one. Okay. So we're going to get past the need thing, but why do we own them in the first place? What's the driving motivation, do you think?
And that's different for every person. And I'm not saying other motivations are wrong. Some people like, I did Olympic competition shooting. Some people have it just to poke a pretty hole in paper, and they never have it for defense, and that's fine. But for me, I think some of the main reasons that I have guns and love guns and do the podcast is that I see it as a means to feed my family. Whether there is really good food, whether there is food at the store or not, good times or bad, I can put meat on the table literally. That's a big deal. And that goes into preserving life in a completely different way, but also preserving life in means of defense, defending my life and the lives of those around me, because I hopefully should honor another person's life as much as my own. And being able to preserve life, human life, mine and other people's, is a big deal, a big responsibility, and a great blessing. And that's, I think, why I really am passionate about guns.
So to me, I think that I agree with that. But my biggest driver is the history and the tradition. And the fact that I mentioned that little Marlin that's probably worth $75 financially, but I can pick that up and I can immediately see a crow that I knocked off at 110 yards out of a tree that somebody, a buddy of mine, made a bet with me I couldn't hit. Right. Or when I have a 1917 Enfield in 30-06, the U.S. Enfield. And some bubba cut it up and sporterized it long before I ever got my hands on it, because I would have never done that to it if I'd got it pristine. But it is a hole puncher, man. And it is, I've shot a lot of deer with it. And I realized that when I'm looking at the serial number, I know that it probably was issued. And it probably served in the European theater in World War I. And when I'm hunting with that gun, I've got over 100 years of history in my hand. Or that when I hand down that A5 to my grandson someday, at that point, that gun's going to have six generations maybe behind it of people that have owned it and handed it down. And to me, that's something that you don't see a lot of things that we can say that about in the modern world. The majority of things that are made today and even have been made for 100 years are not made to last. You know, maybe cast iron cookware sticks around as long, but most things, like this computer that I'm sitting on right now that I bought last year, state of the art MacBook, it's going to be crap in 5 years. Nobody's even going to want it anymore. But the guns that I have, there is no reason other than government that my great, 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 great grandchildren can't sit down with that gun in their hand and tell my story to their grandkids. And I just don't know many things like that. It's part of why I love the 30-06, because it's the father and grandfather of like 80% of what people shoot, right? And it goes all the way back to the turn of the last century, and it's still here, and it's still beautiful, and it still works. And I just don't know that, again, what else can you say that about in our world today?
Yeah.
Art, maybe, you know? That the common man can afford.
Yeah.
Right. You can go buy an heirloom for $300 right now.
Yeah.
It just ain't an heirloom yet. You have to make it into one. But you like maybe knives. Like it's only a few things that have that.
Yeah, that's actually something I haven't really thought about because I don't have kids at home. So maybe that hasn't sunk in for me yet. But I can certainly see that. And I certainly love the history of guns as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And like I said, they're just made to last. So if you think about it, like if I'm making guns today, I can't afford to make a shoddy firearm. Now I know there's some that jam and shit like that, but what I mean is like we'll blow up in the guy's face. Right? I can't afford to do that as a matter of course, because I'm going to get sued into oblivion. So a gun, by its very nature of having an explosive go off inside it, has a certain base level of quality that it needs to be made with if the person or the company making it wants to be in business next year.
Yeah.
And then
one of you talking about the 30-06, one of my go-to guns that I really am blessed to have is a pre-64 Winchester Model 70, 30-06 featherweight.
Hancock. Carlos Hancock's gun.
Yeah. I don't know if this was a featherweight, but featherweight 30-06. I mean, that's my Alaska gun. I lived in Alaska for a while. There's nothing in North America that I wouldn't go toe to toe with that gun. And and it was made pre 64 and it's still going strong. And it, like you said, God willing, it'll go down to generations of people putting meat on the table with it.
Yeah. Another gun I have is a featherweight Winchester Model 12 pump that my uncle bought for $150, you know, and I don't know what that thing's worth today, but I ain't even going to find out because I don't want to know what it's worth because I don't care because it's not going anywhere. You know, and that now is three generations into my family. And like stuff like that, you just don't see it. There's not much else. I mean, Even I've got some old fishing. I have some Mitchell 300 reels that were made in the 60s. But, you know, they don't quite work like they did. But all those old guns still just do what they're supposed to do. And I just think it's a cool thing. Anyway, man, I appreciate you being with us. Let's take a few questions real quick, and then we'll let you go.
Yeah.
Leather Homestead says, I would like to hear his take on training with the 22 or carrying a 22. We kind of hit that. You want to hit a little bit more?
Sure, yeah. I'm not going to pretend that a 22 is the best carry option. It's absolutely not. And most of that isn't even to do with the ballistic performance. Most of that is to do with the fact that it's a rim fire, and they're inherently not as reliable as a center fire. They also don't have the inertia to move the slide and stuff back and forth. So just in general, in my experience, they're not going to be as reliable as a center fire option. So that said, I would much rather you have a 22 that you are good with and proficient with and trained with than a 9mm that you don't, or a 45 that you don't. If you are really good and train a lot with a 22 and you want to carry a 22, that is not a bad choice. You are better with the 22 that you can hit with than the 44 mag that you can't hit with. And that's just a reality, right?
Agreed.
So that's my overarching thought on that. And that's going to vary depending on the 22 handgun in question, but they're absolutely fantastic for training.
The, who's it? Kel-Tec makes that P30. 30, mm-hmm. 30 rounds of 22 Magnum in a gun that carries like a toy. Mm-hmm. Not my first choice, but I sure as hell don't want to be shot 30 times with a 22 Magnum. The 22 kills more people every year than anything else. Like, that's part of that study, right? Like
you said in that study, the difference between people shot and stopped with a 22 versus a 9 is not as big as the marketing would have us believe.
No.
But my issue with the 22 and the 22 Magnum, even more so because it's long and skinny, is more with feeding and reliability.
Correct.
And the stopping power of the weapon.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm all about 22s for small game and training. I just don't think they're the right choice as a carry gun. But if it's what you have, it's better than a sharp stick. River Rat says, thoughts on the A300 Patrol. I don't really know this weapon very well. It's over a grand and it's a shotgun, so I'll let you talk about it.
They're fantastic. It's a gas gun. And when you talk about semi-auto shotguns, which I love, you get your gas guns and your inertia guns. If you want to think about your gas guns like that as your AR-15 and your inertia gun like your AK-47, that gas gun is going to be softer shooting. It's going to be really good for three gun. It's going to be good for police work, but it needs more maintenance. So if you're looking for like an end of the world, this is a survival podcast. If you're looking for like a hard times function no matter what, I would gear more towards a Benelli inertia-driven gun, but that's going to be softer shooting. There are benefits to both operating systems. Beretta makes world-class shotguns. So if you want a gas gun, that's a phenomenal gas gun. But it has the limitations of being a gas gun and going dumping the dirty gas in the operating system. So you're going to have to clean it.
Okay. So this one's directed at me, but you're welcome to comment on it as well. Hardway Homestead, Alaska says, reloading, can I use rifle primers to replace Magnum rifle primers in my 300 Win Mag? Can't find Magnum ones anywhere. You can use them back and forth in my experience. You may not get exactly the same performance, but if you take a large rifle primer standard and you put it in a 300 Win Mag case and you load it otherwise properly, when you pull the trigger, it's going to go bang. And I would just say, if that's where you are, that's where you are, if that's what you're stuck with. But I would load all those rounds, and I would do this. I wouldn't care if it's a different brand of Magnum primer. That batch of ammo needs to be zeroed with and then used. And when you get some, then you need to put it back in reserve or something and do the same thing again, because you definitely are going to have an effect on ballistics in there, and you're going to have an effect on point of impact. What are your thoughts on that?
I would say I'm a big reloader too, been reloading since I was a kid. I would say look for published data that has those primers.
Okay.
I have in the past reloaded Magnum cartridges with non-Magnum primers and gotten higher velocity for whatever reason. So you got to be careful just because it's not a Magnum, just to do with burn rates and ignition and things like that. If you can find published data that some manufacturer, because it's a litigious society, they're not going to put out bad data. So if you can find data with non-Magnum primers, go for it. If there's no data, I'd probably wait, unless that's the only gun that you have or something. But if it's a 300 Win Mag, it's probably not the only gun you have, let's be honest.
I'd also say, like, you always follow certain rules with reloading and starting any new load at 10% under listed maximum. is probably a pretty good idea. And the reason you're seeing that happen is powder burn rates. And so if you used a different powder with that primer, you might get the exact opposite effect.
Yeah.
So you're using a really hot powder with long duration burn rate and a long barrel out of a Magnum, you could end up in a situation where that lower impact of the primer actually creates more duration of burn in the barrel behind the round. And if you're 10% under maximum loads, I guarantee you, you're not going to blow your gun up because you used a different primer. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, that's just my advice, dude. Do what you want. But I've learned the hard way blowing guns up that stick with published data. If it's published, you're probably good.
Yeah, if you publish data, I completely agree with. Josh says his wife, I don't know why I started this, got him a Lee Challenger reloading set for Christmas. Good for you, bro.
Fantastic, yeah.
And it's a great place. Lee is a great place to start, in my opinion.
Yeah, the Lee anniversary is my number one recommendation for anyone to get into reloading.
Yep, because you might decide it's not really for you, and you can have more money into one press from RCBS than everything you need, including components, to start reloading with Lee.
Yeah.
And I'm not crapping on RCBS. I'm just saying your rounds will work the same. I think Richard Lee has probably created more reloaders in the country than any other individual person. Just the accessibility and affordability of Lee product, and it all works. It all works well. Everything I own, other than I do have a, I guess it's Lyman's scale, that has the scale and the powder dispenser for precision reloading by weight. I have one of those, but I bet I was reloading for 15 years before I bought that.
Yeah.
And just using a Lee perfect powder measure, no problems.
Yeah. And some quick advice, if you think you're going to get big into reloading, don't start with a progressive press. Even if you think you're going to get a progressive press, get a single stage. You're always probably going to want a single stage for load development, and then set it on your progressive, because resetting a progressive is like, you know, overhauling an engine. It's a pain in the butt. So get the single stage anyway.
Yeah. And yeah, you're going to want a single stage, even if it's not load development. So our friend there with the 300 Win Mag, how many rounds do you think you're going to fire out of that thing a year?
Yeah.
Right. So if you have an AR, you might want to, once you dial in your load, you set up a progressive to reload 5.56. Okay, I get it. Yeah. I get it. You're going out there, you're slapping a 30-round mag in at the range, and you're dumping it. Okay, I get it. You're shooting a 300 Win Mag, or you're shooting a 338.06 or something like that. You're just not going to fire that many rounds. And I don't know about you, when I reload, it's one of my, like, I talk about how meditation is not always sitting around contemplating your navel. To me, fishing is very meditative. Sporting clays is very meditative. And reloading is very, I'm not trying to get done fast.
No,
you know, I'm really not. And a single stage press is a lot quicker to reconfigure. It's
simple. And it's a lot easier to understand when you're getting into it, too.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to learn with, that's for sure. Last, real quick, homesteading heathen, I just want to say thanks for the super chat. I appreciate that very much, sir. Thank you. And I'll point out at this point, too, in the show today, had a lot of complaints lately about ads during the live stream. Based on the emails that came in to me yesterday, YouTube is not doing what they say for everybody. They're doing it for some, but not all. So some people are getting blasted with ads during a live stream. And since YouTube's not keeping its deal, from here forward until I figure out how to do something different, there just won't be any ads during live streams. So I just let people know, unless they're ads for my sponsors. That's different. Anyway, dude, I really appreciate you being with us today, Michael. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Jay.
I'm going to push Michael into the green room for a minute there and close down with you guys real quick. Just want to remind you guys again, this was the last live stream of 2023. We will not see you again with a new show until January 2nd, 2024. And we're going to have some much needed time off. Tomorrow will be the annual Christmas special. We'll have a Friday flashback after that and some rewinds and stuff next week. As you're getting ready for Christmas and you're running out of time, guys, I want to remind you that Santa Val is here to help. The T-Spaz catalog has a lot of really great items, almost everything in it. I own it, I bought it, and I would buy it again. I do a lot of research, whether it's something like a knife or a flashlight or even a kitchen item. Like, I put a lot of work in before I buy it for myself, and that's where I started doing T-Spaz. And I have, like, the top 15 items that make great gifts listed in a single post. You just go over to the survivalpodcast.com and scroll down till you see Santa Val, and he'll help you out. And I even got a list here of the 10 best-selling items. A few of them are on both lists. Most of them aren't. A lot of these are probably not the greatest gifts, but I just thought it might be fun for you to see what your fellow TSPers mostly purchased in the last year. I just thought that would be cool. And then I do have an item of the day today for you. This is something I've been recommending for damn near ever, the Secura stainless steel insulated French press mugs. And as I've always said, I buy and use the things that I recommend. This is the big one, the 50-ouncer, and they're on sale today for like 36 or 30% off or something like that. So a great deal. They look great. They make a great – anybody you know that's a tea drinker, coffee drinker would love this. Maybe pair it up with some Living Free in Tennessee Holler Homestead coffee or Food Forest Farms coffee and a little grinder or something like that, and it will absolutely be a home run hit with anybody or for yourself, because – this is just a better way to make coffee, in my opinion, than even some really expensive machinery. With that, I am wrapped up. I am very excited to be at the end of this year and have some downtime and some holiday time with my family. I recommend all of you do that as well. Again, stay tuned, though, for what we will put out for you from the archives, because we've got some cool stuff coming up. And I like that. I'm going to start stealing that from Nicole right there. Merry Breakmas. That's exactly what this is. The holidays are the Breakmas season for podcasters. So we will catch you with new content in a new year. Take care, guys.
Are they gonna bail you out or just run you around? They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.